The silent film footage begins with a door. One of those heavy paneled doors they put on postcards of Dublin. And girls in school uniforms are gathering at it. And then the door opens. And the girls are running upstairs, school bags in hand, ponytails swinging.
Never saw this. Ciara O'Sullivan, Keita, Geraldine, Joan, Esther. Oh, my God. Wow. Ah, la, la. And that's me.
I had a long school day and then I'd race cycling home. My mother would pick up my bicycle, hand me my ballet bag. I'd rush down to get the 48A bus. It was quite a trek to get into Parnell Square.
Now the camera is in a dance studio, a big Georgian room with mirrors and tall windows. The girls are wearing black leotards and white tights, and they are holding onto a wooden bar while they do their point work.
And I just remember the sound of all the dancers' shoes rubbing in a kind of battement tendu, that movement, which is the stretch of the foot into a point, sliding the foot on the floor, keeping the foot flat, then stretching it.
And now the dancers are practicing arabesques, pirouettes, jumps. And in the middle is their teacher, a dark-haired woman dressed like Audrey Hepburn in black trousers and a crisp white shirt. She springs forward and back to the music we can't hear, directing and then demonstrating, her eyes following her hand dramatically as she extends her arm.
Patricia! She was so striking, tall, dark.
We thought she was the most beautiful woman we'd ever seen. She was very tall and slim with huge brown eyes. And she wore the most wonderful clothes. And she wore these Louis Jourdan shoes, which I longed to have a pair of. And then she'd kick them off and we'd look at them, say, Louis Jourdan, wow.
And then the scene changes and we see the teacher standing back, a cigarette in hand as she watches the dancers.
This is amazing. She really had us moving. I mean, there was no mucking about.
On the teacher's right is an older woman dressed in a long wool skirt.
Blondie O'Brolican was there with the record player so we could rehearse, and she had a bun always. She was always dressed with a wonderful Irish shawl.
And to the teacher's left is a young male dancer leaning heavily into the bar as he waits his turn, his fringe gelled back James Dean style, and a heavy overcoat hooked loosely over his broad shoulders.
That's Jelko standing there. He's got a coat thrown over him. It must have been quite cold. See what I mean about him being very beautiful? He was from Split in Yugoslavia.
He was the ballet star arriving in to partner myself and Esther. And very theatrical.
Jelko was a charmer. Big, big eyes. Nice dancer. Flapped his eyelashes, everybody liked him. And he was very nice, easy to work with. And when he had never had Club Orange and he used to drink, and his big eyes going, I love fizzy drink.
And behind them, through the tall windows, you can see that it's now dark outside. And imprinted in bold white letters on one window pane, for the world outside to see, are the words National Ballet School.
My name is Penelope Collins. I'm the daughter of Patricia Ryan, who was a dancer and choreographer at the National Ballet Dublin during the late 1950s to the early 1960s.
Penelope Collins lives close to me in Dunleary in Dublin, and after a neighbour introduced us, Penelope told me an extraordinary story about how her mother, Patricia Ryan, had once been the teacher and choreographer of an ambitious Russian-style ballet school in Dublin, and how she'd collaborated with figures such as Patrick Kavanagh. I was fascinated, but later when I googled both Ryan and the ballet school, I found nothing, not even a Wikipedia entry. A few weeks later, Penelope brought me the silent film footage of a 1958 rehearsal in the school's Parnell Square studio, and there was something very moving about seeing the faces of Ryan and her young dancers, their emotional style, their obvious effort. And I wanted to understand why this story of a nascent national ballet had been so entirely forgotten.
The first opening of thinking about the history of the ballet under my mother's teaching came to light at the sad occasion of her funeral. Standing outside Mount Jerome, I was approached by two different people that said, you have to do something about this. Patricia's history is unknown and has to be brought out, and you can do that. I kind of nodded. My head was not really there, but it did sink in somewhere, because many years later, I lifted these papers and bags out of drawers and out of boxes and started to put things together. It occurred to me very quickly that she had kept a considerable amount of documentation. And why? There was so much of it. Checkbooks and invitations and everything was there. Looking at these letters and documents, you start to feel the vigour of it all, the energy of people collaborating and working.
I am happiness.
I could feel orchestras playing and putting together festival nights and choreographies. To see all these dates come to an abrupt end.
Patricia Ryan's involvement with the National Ballet School began with a report in the Sunday Independent on January the 13th, 1957.
Russian-born Madame Nadine Nikolyeva Legat, former prima ballerina of the Bolshoi Theatre and principal of the Legat School of Russian Classical Ballet in London, arrived in Dublin yesterday by air from London. She is here as a guest of the Irish National Ballet School to inspect the students of the school and to help the council provide them with a teacher trained in the Russian classical ballet method.
Ryan, who had once been a promising student of Legat's in London, was now living in the Dublin suburb of Rathgar and married, somewhat unhappily, to literary publisher and artist John Ryan. In one of the fragments of memoir she left behind, she recorded her reaction to the news of Legat's visit.
I saw an article in the press stating that my teacher, Nadine Nikolyeva Legat, was in Dublin and staying at the Shelburne Hotel. She was looking for a teacher to take on the National Ballet School. I telephoned and I said, I must see you. It was marvellous to meet up again. I was the answer to take on the school, she said. At first, I refused. I don't know how to teach. But she talked me through. I knew the Legat system, she said, but she also told me, don't follow my system slavishly. You will find your own way to teach. I was married and had two children, but in the end I said, I'll do it for 6 weeks, and if I feel I can do it, I will continue.
That was a very difficult journey for her, going to see Legat, because she was quite trepidous as she was visiting her teacher from London, who she hadn't seen since she was 16. She was now 33. That's a long time, and a lot of things had happened. And what she felt was that she was a failure. She had been a failure as a dancer. She had been a failure at her marriage. She decided to ring the Shelburne Hotel to surprise her. They put the phone straight up to Legat's bedroom. And when she answered it, she said, Petrushka, straight away, the old fond name that she called her when teaching her in class.
Ryan spoke often of how in her own childhood she had dreamed of dancing like Anna Pavlova and how seeing a performance by Andrei Glevsky with the Ballet Russe had fired her love of Russian ballet and led her to ask her mother to bring her to the Legat school.
I was adamant it must be the Russian system, no other. One day my mother and I travelled up to London to a studio in Baron's Court to see a class in progress. And to my amazement, and to this very day, it is extraordinary. There was Nadine Nikolyeva Legat, the widow of Nikolai Legat, who had taught Nijinsky, taking class. And there in centre stage was Andrei Glevsky himself, performing miraculous eight-turn pirouettes.
Ryan had flourished under Legat, but on the outbreak of war in 1939, her mother and Irish stepfather had moved the family to Ireland. Though Ryan performed for a period with the Irish Ballet Club and the Sarah Payne Company in Dublin, she found the classes boring, and suffering with anxiety, she gave up.
She described it as her time when she had a breakdown. The ballet wasn't working here, and she worried that she was growing too tall. any dancer of the times knows that you couldn't be higher than 5'5" to perform on a stage.
After Sarah Payne's school, I had stopped dancing. I had stopped dead. I was dead. And suddenly I had these students under my hands, and they could continue where I had left off. And that is what they did.
When Ryan joined the National Ballet School as teacher, it had been in existence for 3 years, having been founded by Irish painter and writer Cecil French Salkeld and a Russian dancer named Valentina Dutko. It was unique as a Russian ballet school, and its name suggests the seeds of ambition may have been there from the start. But in 1955, Dutko had left Ireland, and the students had been left without a teacher for over a year.
What is interesting about the school is it didn't follow the system of the Royal Academy of Dance as most ballet schools in Dublin at the time did. It followed a Russian system of training, and this was a different aesthetic and a different style of dance. It was freer, it was quite powerful, and perhaps not as clean and as precise as the Royal Academy of Dancing system was.
That was ballet historian Victoria O'Brien, whose book on the history of Irish ballet contains the only written account of the National Ballet School.
There was a core group of about 10 dancers, all girls, who used to attend class every day. There was Esther O'Brien, Geraldine Morris, Joan Wilson, and they were quite disciplined. I believe they used to take dance class every day after school.
One of the young girls involved in the first years of the National Ballet School was Esther O'Brolacorn. Her parents, Blonard and Owen O'Brolacorn, supported the running of the school, and indeed it was Blonard O'Brolacorn who had written to Legat. Esther is now nearly 80 years old and lives near Rome, but she is on a brief visit to Dublin.
I need a strong hand.
I should have warned you about the steps, shouldn't I, at my house?
You have to open first.
It's all open.
Oh, it's open. My eyesight is as good as my arms and legs.
My father was Owen O'Brolacorn. His father was also one of the first ministers of education. My mother was Blonard Dillon. Her mother was Joseph Mary Plunkett's sister. My parents and my grandparents as well were terrific supporters of the arts in any form and lovers of art.
Esther's parents encouraged her early interest in dance by bringing her to performances of visiting ballet companies.
The first thing I saw was Catherine Dunham, who was African-American. She also had a degree in anthropology, which was very unusual for the time. I was 4, 1948. And then there was Festival Ballet and Ballet Rambert. Royal Ballet came not very often because they're sort of a big company. And apparently, one of the first times my parents took me to ballet, I got up from my seat and I was standing in the middle of the aisle of the theatre, and they said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I've got to see what they're doing under the dresses. I want to see the feet."
Esther recalls what it was like for her and the other students of the small National Ballet School in the year between Dutko's departure and Patricia Ryan's arrival.
We were so passionate about what we did that we came in every day. By that stage, I would have been 10, nearly 11, I think. We came in every day. My mother put on the music, and we did what we remembered. Now, obviously, we made lots of mistakes, but we tried to reproduce the class, the daily class.
Patricia Ryan later recalled her impression of the young students and her first months working with them.
As I took my first class, I was so unsure, but under me were 12 pupils with a marvellous response and passion for such young students. I was thrown in the deep end as a recital was already arranged to take place in the dark hall in the Royal Irish Academy of Music. One day, listening to an extract from Chopin's Les Sylphides, I slipped on the other side of the record to hear the strange and most beautiful descriptive music, Euro Peru by Villa-Lobos. There I had it, the storyline. I brought in a friend to look after the sound effects, since we performed to tape then. I asked my husband John to design the decor as cheaply as possible. The setting was the Brazilian forest. Difficult, yet he had the brilliant idea of a series of panels suspended backstage. The forest, as such, would be taken over by some of the dancers, moving slowly and draped in chiffon and leaves, hunters looking for a magic bird. The whole thing was wildly successful.
The classes were terrific, but even more than the classes, her choreography was inspired and wonderful to dance, because it was so musical. It was one ballet I didn't like, and I know why I didn't like it. It was because I didn't have a solo part.
Victoria O'Brien feels that Patricia Ryan quickly developed her own style of teaching.
Patricia, who had been trained by Nadine Legat in London, didn't completely follow the Russian style of ballet. I think she incorporated Cecchetti, which is the Italian system.
Although Ryan's initial joy at her second chance in the ballet world was obvious, letters show she relied on Madame Legat, who became patron of the school, for encouragement and connection to the ballet world. Legat wrote to Ryan ahead of a visit by the Royal Ballet to Dublin in 1957, urging Ryan not to think of herself as any less than guest dancer Margot Fonteyn, whose real name was Peggy Hookham.
The Legat School, Tunbridge Wells, under the patronage of Her Imperial Highness Grand Duchess Xenia of Russia. You have become self-conscious, darling. Turn back the pages and remember that you stood at the bar with these people and were on an equal level with Margot Fonteyn, Peggy Hookham. Go and speak to her of the past and tell her that you were trained at the Legat studio. Have more confidence, darling. Buck up and speak for yourself. Do as I say, my dear. Remember, and this is I am telling you, you had not less talent than Margot Fonteyn. You did not go her way, because you stopped dancing, and this is all. Go ahead, darling. Life is a battle. Fight and fight well. It is not for me to teach Irish people how to fight. Nadine Nikolyeva Legat.
I'm in London, and I've just arrived at Covent Garden Station, and I'm making my way up the 193 steps out of the station. Whew. On my way to meet Dr. Geraldine Morris, who is, of course, a former National Ballet School and Company student and dancer. Hello, Geraldine.
Hello, Joanna. It's great to meet you. Lovely to be here.
Thank you so much for bringing me to the Royal Opera House. It's very exciting. It's the first time I've been in since I was a teenager, actually. And I've never been backstage, that's for sure.
Well, it's a changed environment from when I was here. We're sitting at the back of the stalls in the opera house, and there's a stage rehearsal, a piano rehearsal going on stage of the Nutcracker. Without Patricia, I would never have joined the Royal Ballet. I would never have had the advantage of going to the Legat School for a term. I would never have had that input of really good technical classes without her. Madame Legat, she was very Russian with a gammy leg, and she would limp into class, sit down at the piano, and she played all the way through. She played her own music for the class. She was quite fierce, but she was very kind, a very nice woman. And she had this bright red hair, and her school in Tunbridge Wells was quite famous.
Legat travelled to Dublin to conduct examinations regularly, and after one such visit in April 1958, she wrote to Ryan. It is clear from the letter that Ryan's confidence and ambition for the National Ballet School has grown.
I was quite pleased with the results of the examination. I hope that this idea to promote a national ballet will not leave you. You are the most suitable person from every aspect to organize such a school and to stand at the head of it. I am so pleased that you have now really taken the bit between your teeth, in spite of your great responsibilities at home. This gives you an extra feather in your cap, and it means that you are unusual, and it will bring you still more admiration.
By late 1958, the National Ballet School had moved into a larger studio at 39 Parnell Square, the location of the silent film footage, and its repertoire had grown. A recital ran for 5 nights in Dag Hall that November, acknowledging in its programme support from the Arts Council. Through Legat, visiting dancers Jelko Yuresha and Anna Truscott came to Dublin, Angelco performed in the Lac des Cygnes Pas de Deux with Joan Wilson and in Sleeping Beauty's Bluebird Pas de Deux with Esther O'Brolacorn. In the audience was Irish poet and ballet expert Monk Gibbon, and he wrote to the Irish Times afterwards.
Sir, your critic raises an issue of importance to all lovers of ballet in this country when he praises the really excellent programme of the National Ballet School and then asks, Quo Vadis? We have now got a school of ballet, a teacher of ballet, and a number of young ballet dancers demonstrably comparable, put it to the test, sceptic, if you like, by making your way to Dag Hall, to the London standard. What is going to happen to them? Are we merely to become a recruiting ground for the big cross-channel companies like Festival? Or is there a chance of our keeping our young dancers here and enjoying the rich reward of the balletomain, of watching a striking talent develop and deepen over the years?
News of the company's success reached Legat in London.
My dear Petrushka, I've heard from Anna Angelko of your successes and rejoice. I do hope that you will soon develop and have an orchestra and that eventually you will become the Irish National Ballet Company and dance at Covent Garden.
The National Ballet School was now calling itself the National Ballet Company, and its artistic achievements were becoming more widely recognised. But behind the scenes, Patricia Ryan's marriage to John Ryan was falling apart, and she had begun an affair with painter Patrick Collins.
It was at a party in the house. John was then the editor of Envoy magazine, and the house was the home of many literary gatherings that moved through heavy drinking. It was Arthur Power who called me over to the fireplace. "I want you to meet someone, a painter," he said. I can't remember the conversation, but I recall my thoughts. "So this is the man who paints Celtic poetry? He looks like a bank clerk." I was aware of the perfume of his heavy pomade. Each time our paths crossed, I took in more of this man. The set of his shoulders, his slow, beautiful hands, his politeness towards me. And a physical attraction slowly took hold of me. This man came so overwhelmingly into my life. A life that, on the surface, had the trappings of wealth and comfort and a safe marriage.
Like John Ryan, Patrick Collins was very much part of the Dublin literary scene. When Patricia was away for a few days, he wrote this letter to her, referring to a recent night out with Arthur and Doris Power and artists Charlie and Isla Brady.
12 Parliament Street, Dublin. My dear Patricia, thought your letter would never come. Was actually expecting something on Saturday, then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. It seemed endless, but worth waiting for. Tried to send you some flowers, have always wanted to, and discovered that a dozen roses can cost up to £8 in Dublin. Crazy! Didn't have £8 anyway. Dublin seems empty. A big gap in every crowd. You. Met the Powers and the Bradys in Davy Burns the other night. Everybody yammering away and a drink coming up every hour. 10:30 brought some deliverance. And then someone suggested the Arts Club. God almighty. I went home, followed by a couple of dirty looks. Have been working most evenings since you went away and a picture nearly finished. Must stick at it now and produce. Life is real and life is earnest. It may not have happiness, but it must have meaning. But when I am working, I keep thinking of your footsteps on the stairs, two at a time. And I miss you. Miss you. Miss you.
On the 13th of December 1957, Patricia gave birth to her third child, daughter Penelope, in Hatch Street Nursing Home. She was at this stage still living with John Ryan, and her brother Jimmy was present when she went into labour. It was clear from the letter she wrote to Patrick Collins that he was the father.
Dear Paddy, I do hope I can get this posted. I wish with all my heart that you could come and see me. But I suppose it's too difficult. I told Jimmy on Friday when it started to get in touch with you, but he either got too drunk or in a flap, and I think he was worried in case he would have to witness a birth. Anyway, he told me on Sunday that he still hadn't contacted you. I was very shocked and sat him down to phone you, as you know. The baby is lovely. Very dark. If only you could see her.
We knew that she was with Patrick Collins, the painter. We knew that she was expecting a baby because she was sitting giving class with her hands on her tummy, looking very happy. And that was Penelope.
Despite the turmoil in their private life, John Ryan continued to design the sets for many of the National Ballet Company's ballets, including for Ryan's first original ballet, Careless Love, which was a collaboration with libretto writer Donna McDonagh and Irish composer A.J. Potter. I'm on my way to Birr, County Offaly, on a frosty January morning to visit dancer Joan Wilson, who performed in Careless Love and who moved back to Ireland from Belgium a few years ago.
Hello, how nice to meet you. Come in, the hall is cold, but it's warm upstairs. Just a second.
Patricia created Careless Love on myself and Donald McAlpine. And the story is a young girl in the village in Ireland who is more or less engaged to the young piper. And suddenly into the midst of this innocent village comes the city girl. Who is not at all like them, very sophisticated, dressed differently, jeweled differently. Her way of moving is sensual, it's sexual in a sense, which shocked the villagers a lot. And the young piper is very attracted to this newness. They slip into a boudoir. And there's a bed and a huge picture of the Sacred Heart with the lamp burning under it. So we just went onto the bed, but in full view of the Sacred Heart.
Careless Love was first performed in April 1960 at the Olympia Theatre, with Joan in the role of City Girl and Esther O'Brolican in the role of the Village Girl. A review of the first performance in the Irish Times referred to standing ovations and wrote that Ryan's ballet had exploited all the comic, satiric and tragic romantic twists and that Potter's music had come to magnificent Stravinskian life with the dancing.
The next day, the villagers are enraged and slowly but surely they close the doors on the couple and don't give them food. The piper goes begging on his own, but he couldn't get anything for her, so she dies of starvation. The villagers and the young village girl are delighted, and they carry this poor dead woman off the stage joyously. And the young village girl is smiling gently in the corner, combing her hair. I remember Esther doing that. Careless Love was fabulous. I mean, you could put all your guile into it. Liberate yourself.
In those days, it was considered good behaviour never to bring up sex, certainly for the girls who looked to marriage as a desired epoch in our lives. That meant under no circumstances to be anything else but completely untouched by male hands. We were all schooled in, if you don't do it, you won't want to. Never go the whole hog. You don't have needs.
Ryan negotiated the entry of dancers into the union Irish Actors Equity. And on the 31st of December 1961, she provided dancers for the first Radio Televisieran broadcast.
I have great hopes in this new service. I am confident that those who are in charge will do everything in their power to make it useful for the nation.
Norman Maine came to Dublin to head up dance on Radio Telefiche Éireann, and we performed at the opening of Radio Telefiche Éireann at midnight.
Could you describe that?
Yes, it was terrible.
They'd got a new aeroplane in Aer Lingus, so the brilliant idea was that all the performers, and there was Maureen Potter, who was a comedian, and other people, we'd all come out of the aeroplane and perform on the tarmac. And Norman said, "Darlings, there might be a breeze. Put some lacquer in your hair." It was a 40-mile-an-hour gale.
And the thing was frozen. You couldn't walk on it. So we had to use kettles of boiling water to clear the water around the plane so we could dance. And I went home and had pneumonia, you know, just by the way.
As the reputation of the National Ballet Company and its dancers grew, so did Ryan's appetite for new collaborations. Her overtures were not always successful, but they were taken seriously by figures as significant as Samuel Beckett.
6 Rue des Favorites, Paris, 12th December 1960. Dear Mrs. Ryan, thank you for your letter. Perhaps someday I shall be able to offer you something of the kind you want, but for the moment I'm afraid it is quite impossible. My friend Derek Mendel, who played Act Without Words in London and Paris, has already asked me for a ballet with words, argument and text. I feel quite unable to write such a work. If I ever do, I must give it to Mendel. And if then I ever do a second, I shall be happy to give it to you. Yours sincerely, Samuel Beckett.
Gamble, No Gamble is a ballet based on spoken verse, ballet based on a poet's thoughts. I don't think that ever before has there been such a close integration of thought, music, and choreography as in Gamble, No Gamble.
That was newly discovered archive audio of RTE commentator Norris Davidson introducing a broadcast of Ryan's second original ballet, Gamble, No Gamble. The music was performed by the Radio Éireann Light Orchestra and the poem spoken by actor T.P. McKenna.
Patricia Ryan collaborated for the second time with A.J. Potter on a ballet called Gamble, No Gamble. Again, her husband John Ryan designed the sets. It premiered in 1961 at the Queen's Theatre in Dublin. But what is really interesting about this particular ballet is that the libretto was written by the Irish poet Patrick Kavanagh. And the poem, which is recited during the piece, is repeated over the course of the piece. So it's like a roulette wheel that constantly turns, I believe. That was the whole notion of it. I think the set had roulette wheels in it as well. The score is considered one of the great accomplishments of A.J. Potter.
The whip in your hand, that croupier splendid, who has luck all upended as the game is suspended. And as I, the High King, decide everything, you have now had your fling. Death, die, fate.
Penelope Collins remembers her mother talking about Kavanagh.
Finding Patrick Kavanagh to get the next verses of the long poem was not an easy task. She had to find him in an array of Dublin pubs, root him out and pay for an age-old whiskey and slip him a fiver, and that's how they collaborated. Patrick Kavanagh wasn't particularly interested in ballet, describing it as, "What would I be doing with dancers leaping around the stage?" But despite that, apparently he turned up on opening night and found the way backstage to get to the wings and to walk straight onto the apron of the stage with the dancers standing behind him and A.J. Potter in the wings as well, and talked to the audience about his ballet.
Sometime later, Paddy carefully suggested that I leave John. Through a friend of Donna McDonough, I found a house in Monkstown. The move was undramatic. For the first time, I had a man who'd leave for work at 8 a.m. and return on the dot of 4:30. Was I happy? Yes. And yet quiet guilt followed me.
By 1962, Patricia Rhine realised probably one of her most exciting and ambitious plans, which was to establish a festival or a ballet week. And during this week, she wanted to bring over not only the British dancers who she had worked with before, Ronald Hyde and Annette Page, but also dancers from Russia. And it's quite interesting because at this stage, it's very much the Iron Curtain. It's the height of the Cold War.
With no Russian embassy in Dublin, Rhine first contacted the Russian embassy in London and then, on their advice, made a direct appeal to the Minister of Culture in Moscow.
If you can let us have two dancers, we shall be greatly honoured. Our means are modest, so that we could not hope to pay more than the expenses, though of course we should be happy to welcome their personnel. I am convinced that our country would give them the warm-hearted welcome which they deserve.
For Patricia to bring over two leading Russian artists to Ireland was really quite an accomplishment. We can see that the repertoire that they performed during that week, which was for 6 days, the British dancers performed on the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then the Russian dancers performed on the Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And it gave Dublin audiences the opportunity to see the difference aesthetically and in technique of the two different styles of ballet. Productions such as Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty, Don Quixote, Le Corsaire.
When I arrived at the stage rehearsal, I was horrified to see marching up and down the street outside the Olympia, men and women with placards saying that the Irish people would not attend any performance given by the godless people. It certainly didn't have the required effect, for the theatre was booked out for the whole week. What more can there be to tell except the Legion of Mary capitulated and sent an invitation to the Russians to go to tea? I went with them, and we were trapped into Irish dancing, and the dancer and minister and all were given holy medals, and cards, and posters of the crucifixion. And thankfully, that was that. I think the Russians were perplexed with the whole thing, but remained very polite. The week was a staggering success, the audience experiencing for the first time the exacting lifts, the brio of their technique, people standing in the aisles and responding with a standing ovation, cheers to lift the roof. I had what I desired, to give the Irish this experience of witnessing the first Russian dancers perform here.
They didn't speak any English, so needed to have interpreters. They were very nice, very pleasant, but they were Bolshoi-style, huge movement, which we thought was wonderful.
They were followed by the KGB, these two Russians, who were as poor as church mice. Like, she had the oldest tutu, and the makeup was prehistoric, this poor woman.
She was Nina Minovchikova and he was Vladimir Kruglov. And the reason that it sent them over was because Vladimir had a little girl at home, age two or that age, and Nina had a little boy at home. They knew they'd go back to Russia otherwise, because just the time when they were going to escape from left, right and centre.
Looking at papers collated by Ryan's daughter Penelope, it's noticeable that by 1962 there were no more letters from Legat, and that on programmes, Legat's name had been replaced by the founder of the Royal Ballet, Dame Ninette de Valois, who had become president of the National Ballet Company. Correspondence shows that for Ballet Week, de Valois had supplied lead dancers and costumes for Swan Lake, and there are reams of letters from other collaborators, such as choreographers Alan Beale, Meriel Evans and Christopher West, and conductor Kenneth Alwyn. However, the volume of paperwork relating to this period, including accounts and reminders of unpaid bills, speaks to the increasing administrative burden of running the ballet and to some financial difficulty. Indeed, after Ballet Week, Rhine asked de Valois if she might talk to her for advice, and in response she received this letter, which seems to contain a degree of reproach.
Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, London WC2. Dear Miss Rhine, thank you very much for your interesting letter about your season in Dublin. I was very pleased to hear that it all went so well. I wish I could have come over, but please tell the powers that be who do the organising to let me have more notice. I received my invitation only 2 days before the performance, so that I had to reply by telegram. I assure you that if I had had more notice, I would have made arrangements to come over. Of course, I would like to see you when I come to Ireland next time, and I will ring up your studio. Yours sincerely, Ninette de Valois.
Countless times, she said in relation to what happened in the ballet, she said, I'm a casualty of the Peter Principle. And I asked her, what is the Peter Principle? And she explained that she was pushed above her level of competence, that her forte was teaching choreographically and designing ideas for her dances on stage, and not as an administrator.
In October 1963, under financial pressure and in the hope of securing greater funding from the Arts Council, Ryan's National Ballet Company entered into a doomed partnership with the Irish Theatre Ballet in Cork. It was announced in the Evening Echo on the 26th of October.
The country's two principal ballet companies, the Irish Theatre Ballet Cork and the National Ballet Dublin, were merged and became the Irish National Ballet at an informal ceremony in Dublin's Shelburne Hotel last evening. Two ladies who have been associated with the two companies for a considerable time and whose names are synonymous with ballet, Miss Joan Denise Moriarty and Miss Patricia Ryan, became joint artistic directors of the new organisation. They shook hands over a wedding cake to mark the occasion at last evening's ceremony.
At this time, Ryan and AJ Potter were working together on their third collaboration, Kathleen Vogt, a satirical ballet with both words and music by Potter, which was broadcast by RTÉ Radio, again with commentary by Norris Davidson.
Patricia Ryan was director of the National Ballet Company, that's to say the Dublin Company, before its amalgamation with Irish Theatre Ballet, the Cork Company. This ballet, Kathleen Vogt, is a collaboration, and clearly a very close one, between Patricia Ryan and Dr. A.J. Potter, whose music was written for this rather difficult production.
Dancer Jim Hughes, who grew up in Dublin's Henrietta Street and now lives in Australia, joined Ryan's Corps de Ballet just before the merger with Cork and performed in Kathleen Vogt.
It was a beautiful work. I thought it was a step forward. In order to create a national company, one has to get away from just doing the classics. Because when one does the classics, it's measured by the Royal Ballet and what's actually happening in London. And that's rather unfair because although some of the people are very well trained, they're not up to that standard. So the way to evolve was to create works from within the Irish context itself.
The lead roles were danced by Joan O'Hara from the Cork side of the company and guest dancer Colin Russell. Actor and theatre impresario Micheál MacLearmore was in the audience on November the 14th, 1963, and afterwards he wrote excitedly to Ryan.
My dear Patty, all my thanks for a wonderful half hour. Such passion and invention is glorious. You should be very proud of tonight. Archie's music I found superb, and your O'Hara girl a find. Why don't you let her dress in a full-length, trailing, mysterious skirt? It would add to her enchantment. The white girls were charming, and the man, I mean Colin Russell, deeply impressive. I'm so glad you and Joan have, as you might say, got married. Don't misunderstand me. Even if you are unhappy together, most marriages are. Sometimes they produce something worthwhile. Micheál MacLearmore.
The artistic differences between Ryan and her co-director Moriarty were well known, and in the first months of 1964, dozens of newspaper articles reported the financial difficulties being experienced by their new Irish National Ballet. Ryan made repeated pleas for state and public support, and de Valois visited Dublin to help, but nonetheless in March the Irish Independent made a sad announcement.
The Irish National Ballet has disbanded. 8 members of the company left for England last night, and 4 more are to leave this week, leaving only 1 member of the present company.
This is what is so disappointing. You know, when the company folds, we can see Geraldine Morris goes to the Royal Ballet School for a year or so, and then is invited to join the Royal Ballet Company. Judith McGilligan goes to Leonard Massine's company. Joan Wilson goes to Brussels to the Ballet Charleroi. Esther Brooklong goes to Rome. And some of the dancers, I go with Norman Maine to the UK to work in a more commercial and television side of things. But I suppose what this is reflective of is the standard that these dancers had attained. And it is so sad that all of them had to leave Ireland in order to pursue their dreams of working professionally.
You see, sadly, when that amalgamation occurred of the Irish National Ballet with the Cork people, and it didn't work out, I came back from London after being trained, and I was very interested. I wanted to live in Ireland and have my career there. And I think when the whole thing collapsed, I wasn't aware of how hurt Patricia was. To be honest with you, I was very selfish. I just thought, this is the end of ballet in Ireland for me.
I put my heart and soul into it. I put in whatever I had left. That's what I gave. What I had left. A class every day for those years. And I went to the government and asked for 23,000 to keep it going, but they wouldn't pay the dancers as professionals to get it all going, to keep them together. They wouldn't move. And the dancers were all 18 or 19 and they wanted to buy their point shoes, their clothes. I was just on the point of keeping a nucleus of dancers together. Lady Gregory had offered us the gate without charge for a week, but without money the dancers drifted away because they had other offers. It all petered out. I stopped. That was me. I stopped. That was it.
Ryan eventually married painter Patrick Collins, but she never taught ballet again.
The famous saying of a dancer dies twice is true. Once you can't dance because you are dance, you have a certain death.
Perhaps in the case of Ryan, she died three times. Once when she stopped dancing, once when she stopped teaching, and finally in 2011.
I must say, it makes me sad, having returned to Ireland after 53 years dancing and teaching abroad, that everybody seems to have forgotten the original Irish National Ballet and all the wonderful people involved.
I'm walking around Parnell Square and I've just passed the Hugh Lane Gallery on my right. And I'm coming down the hill again now, and I'm looking out for number 39. I see 33, 35, 36. And I'm at number 39 Parnell Square. And it's a very smart building, and the door is actually open. And I think it's a language school now. And I can't resist just sticking my head in the door here. I can see the staircase. I had, out of the blue, a memory just descend into my thinking an evening way, way back when Paddy was still alive and we were going to an opening in the Hugh Lane Gallery. And we got into a taxi. My mother and I were sitting in the back. He was in the front and chatting as usual to the taxi driver. And as we came up to the top of O'Connell Street and took a left there up by the rotunda, we were slowing down. And she leant across me, she was on my right, and she leant across me on Parnell Square and pointed over me. Up there, that's where I used to teach, she said. That was my ballet school. And I looked up and I was looking at windows that she kind of pointed at. And I said, oh goodness, I didn't know it was there. And I looked back at her to continue. And it was like she'd evaporated. She was turned completely away from me, completely into the back of the Garden of Remembrance, into those bushes and the railings. She was just gone.
Et maintenant, que vais-je faire de tout ce temps? Que sera ma vie? De tous ces gens
chemin diffère. Maintenant que tu es parti, toutes ces nuits, pourquoi, pour qui? Et ce matin qui revient pour rien, ce cœur qui bat, pour qui, pourquoi, qui bat trop fort, trop fort.